This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Haiti throws out the results of last year's rigged elections in defiance of the U.S. State Department. And why should we allow banks to rip off poor people with usurious payday loans when the post office could do the job a lot cheaper? But first, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, does not hesitate to demonstrate, whether it's marking the anniversary of the 1967 rebellion in Newark, New Jersey, or protesting President Obama's attempt to cut Social Security. Recently, POP hit the streets to protest New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's executive order that sets up a blacklist of companies that have agreed to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. Larry Hamm is chairman of POP. He's also a Bernie Sanders delegate to the upcoming Democratic National Convention.
I believe, and so do other organizations, believe that it is blatantly unconstitutional. That it smacks of McCarthyism. The minute you start talking about creating a blacklist simply because people have a position that's different from anyone's personal position or maybe even the general position of society. But yet, we're supposed to have freedom of speech, freedom to dissent, freedom to disagree. And we think that it's unconstitutional and it's a violation of the Bill of Rights, not to mention that is just outright reactionary. I mean, in Israel right now, according to no less than Bishop Desmond Tutu of the Anglican Church, Israel has created, and Bishop Tutu didn't say an apartheid state. He said it's worse than apartheid. The way the Palestinian people are overtly, covertly, institutionally, and otherwise treated in the state of Israel, and what the boycott, divestment, sanctions, that is the BDS movement, seeks to do is to apply pressure to Israel in the same way it was applied to South Africa, to call for boycotts of companies that strengthen the apartheid system that exists in Israel. When I say apartheid, people think South Africa as a paradigm, and what you had is a situation of one racial group oppressing another. And in Israel, what you have is a situation with one national group, Israelis, oppressing the Palestinians. It's not just a matter of military repression. It's the denial of rights and equality before the law for Palestinians. So the BDS movement seeks to apply pressure to Israel to dismantle its apartheid state, to recognize the rights of the Palestinians, and also to recognize the rights of the Palestinians to self-determination, to a state of their own, if that is what they choose to do, but to end their oppression and recognize their right to self-determination. So we oppose the move by Governor Cuomo to create this blacklist of any agencies that divest from companies because they do business with Israel. And we oppose similar legislation that's being proposed on this side of the Hudson in the New Jersey state legislature.
Boycotts are about as nonviolent a protest as you can get, but apparently that's too radical for not just Cuomo, but for Hillary Clinton as well.
Right. And remember, and I know people might raise an eyebrow if I quote former President John Kennedy on this, but remember, it was he who said, those who make peaceful evolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. It's just ridiculous that people would go after the BDS movement, which is peaceful, nonviolent, seeking to bring about change through the existing social structures here at home and abroad, Why go after them when they're trying to do this in a peaceful way and ignore the violence and oppression that is being done to the Palestinian people every day? What's happened to the Palestinians is despicable. The bombing of Gaza, what they have to go through on a daily basis. Just today, I heard a report on the radio that says that now 95% of the water being used by the Palestinians is not fit for human consumption. And whatever good water the Palestinians had access to is being siphoned off for these illegal settlements in the West Bank. And that's just one more of probably 1,001 examples of how the Palestinian people are being oppressed. And we must do all we can to end that oppression and to have their right to self-determination be recognized. And more specifically, out of the United States, we have to have a foreign policy that, in fact, is not, I mean, tilted would be a word that obscures more than it reveals that we have a foreign policy that's tilted toward Israel. We have a foreign policy that's practically written by the Zionists, and any deviation just creates all kinds of firestorms. The least little word, you know, that President Obama might utter, or least little thing U.S. government might do to at least make it appear we have a balanced foreign policy, you get howls from all directions here in the United States. But the fact is that we have a foreign policy that works for the Zionists in Israel. That's what our policy. It works to keep them in power. It works to maintain the status quo. And we need a foreign policy that will bring about change, that will bring about an end to the oppression and suffering of the Palestinian people, recognize their right to self-determination, recognize their right to a Palestinian state, if in fact that's what they want. That's the task for those of us who are here in the United States, to reshape the foreign policy of our government with regards to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
This situation will be debated at the Democratic National Committee. You are a delegate on the Bernie Sanders side to the convention in Philadelphia, and the People's Organization for Progress has endorsed Bernie Sanders. But Hillary Clinton is down with Israel all the way.
It's disgraceful. And first of all, let me say that the People's Organization for Progress, we as an organization, after months of discussion about the upcoming presidential election, we endorsed Bernie Sanders back in January. And we were working to try to convince specifically people in the urban communities and especially African Americans that Bernie Sanders represented a better deal, let's say, than Hillary Clinton did. With regards to BDS and the Democrats, you know, I was just outraged 1 month ago. It was in one of the earlier debates that Sanders and Clinton had, and Hillary Clinton attacked the BDS movement. I mean, of all the things to attack, all the dimensions that merit criticism in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Hillary Clinton came out with a frontal attack on the BDS movement, almost as if the BDS movement was equivalent to some type of terrorist organization. The BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel, seeks to peacefully pressure Israel to change its policies, to change its apartheid policies toward the Palestinian people. And it does so through peaceful means such as boycott, such as divestment, and calling for sanctions. And I thought for Clinton to attack the BDS movement was not only outrageous, but it was the most blatant form of pandering to the right-wing Zionists here in this country. There was an article recently in the New York Times talking about how the Sanders appointments to the platform committee were in fact raising the question of a more balanced foreign policy in the Middle East and how this was going to become, seemed like a very divisive issue at the Democratic National Convention. My hope, my earnest hope, is that candidate Sanders and his appointees to the platform committee will stand fast and fight as hard as possible for not just a more balanced foreign policy, but for a just foreign policy. Because what we have now is an unjust foreign policy in the Middle East. And I hope that they will stand their ground and support a more just foreign policy. And I, as a delegate, will certainly vote when given the opportunity in favor of any such platform planks for a just foreign policy that are put forward by either the appointees to the committee or the committee itself.
Well, we kind of know what kind of foreign policy President Hillary Clinton would pursue because she's been Secretary of State, and she was a big hawk on attacking Libya, and she's called for no-fly zones over Syria. And when Muammar Gaddafi was killed, she proclaimed in very undiplomatic fashion, "We came, we saw, he died." Does it give you anxiety, the prospect of her being the commander-in-chief?
Anxiety is too kind a term for what I feel about this whole convoluted situation that we're faced with. But my position is that people should start demonstrating now against what I understand that thousands of people will be coming to Philadelphia. And I support their right to demonstrate in Philadelphia. I know that everything possible that can be done by government at all levels they're trying to do right now in Philadelphia in terms of suppressing people's right to protest and suppressing the number of protests that people want to hold. But I hope that among the things that people will be calling for when they demonstrate will be no war with Syria. Because I'm telling you, I expect that if Hillary Clinton is elected in not too long a term, she will try to take us to war with Syria. As you described her, she is a hawk, and we do have evidence of what her future policies will be by virtue of what she's advocated for while she was Secretary of State. And she did push, she was amongst that faction of the administration that convinced President Obama to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, who was one of the staunchest allies of the anti-apartheid movement, not just in South Africa, but for the liberation of Southern Africa in general and support of all the liberation movement in that part of the continent. She advocated his overthrow, and now what was once the Libyan state, which was stable and had, according to the United Nations, one of the highest, if not the highest, standard of living on the continent. Now, Libya is stateless, is in chaos, and essentially has become a rear base for ISIS and the other groups that the U.S. says it is fighting against. So we talk about judgment. Clinton was talking about judgment. Clearly, she had the wrong judgment, just as her judgment was wrong regarding the Iraq war. People should not forget she voted for the Iraq war. And look at the chaos and destabilization of that entire region of the world, not just Iraq, but the entire Central Asia region has been destabilized and literally is on fire because of the war in Iraq, which Hillary Clinton voted for. So, believe me, I have no illusions as to what Clinton administration will do with regard to foreign policy.
In Philadelphia, you'll be on the inside, which I suspect will feel just a little bit strange since the People's Organization for Progress is one of the most demonstrating organizations in the whole country.
Yes, but because I'm on the inside, does not necessarily mean that there won't be top members on the outside demonstrating. And we will be discussing how we are going to relate to what's going to be going on in Philadelphia. But I have my suspicions that while I'll be inside with other Sanders delegates that there will be POP members who will be on the outside participating in these protests.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. The city of Philadelphia is welcoming the Democrats to town, but the welcome mat does not extend to protest marchers. Sherry Honkala is a longtime poor people's activist based in Philadelphia.
On July 25th at 3 o'clock, and we don't want people to get the time mixed up because the city is trying to maneuver to have all of Broad Street shut down just to keep our march from happening. But we're going to march anyways, and Colonel Ann Wright, retired Colonel Ann Wright, will be joining us. Rosa Clemente, Immortal Technique, just tons of other folks that have been calling day in and day out and saying this is absolutely uncalled for, and they're all going to be marching with us. And the reason why this is absolutely disgraceful is because every other event that's taking place that has permits are all either directly or indirectly connected to the Democratic Party. So unless you are a part of the Democratic Party, you have no voice whatsoever in the city. They are painting the grass. They are fencing every vacant lot. They are taking their $43 million and ensuring that there's an entire police state during the Democratic National Convention. And they're doing this in a city that hasn't housed anybody in over 9 months. They're doing it in a city where we have the number one highest drug overdose rate. They're doing it in the fifth largest city in the country that has the highest poverty rate, and they're not going to be able to hide us. And there's threats every 3 days that they're just going to do massive sweeps and lock us up so that we're not able to be at any marches or able to speak out. They can't lock us all up. So we're encouraging folks to, you know, get a hold of their courage. Know that we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors, and we have a responsibility to ensure that we're not silenced during this process. And we intend to march up the south side of Broad Street 25th.
And this is the unauthorized march because, as you say, Philadelphia will be very friendly that week to Democrats, but not to folks like you who are representing poor and homeless families and independent politics.
Yes, absolutely. It's called the March for Our Lives because that's exactly what it is. It's the March for Our Lives. Our march will begin with poor and homeless families, people in wheelchairs, our seniors, our veterans that can't find employment. And even if we risk arrest, we all intend to march up Broad Street to the front doors of the Democratic National Convention. And we're encouraging people to rip up their voter registration cards as Democrats and re-sign up, leave en masse the Democratic Party, and join any party that's independent. Because literally, you know, our planet and the people are in jeopardy right now. Things are going down. We're asking for international human rights observers because this thing is no joke. This is probably going to be the first march that's going to be monitored with droids.
Yes, the Philadelphia police have a vicious reputation, and although I'm sure they've been told to be friendly to the Democrats that they're hosting, that does not necessarily apply to poor folks and black folks and dissidents.
Absolutely. I mean, Philly is famous for, or infamous, for the MOVE bombing, for characters like Rizzo. And so this is definitely a city that knows how to bury the worst possible ills and tragedies that they bestow to, you know, people that live here. We're definitely getting ready. We know that also before conventions, they do major sweeps of the homeless. They've already begun that project in Center City. So we're getting ready to set up a Clintonville based on the Hoovervilles of the 1930s and the Great Depression. And so we're encouraging people to come by Clintonville when they're in town and to listen to the testimony of people that are living here that can't feed themselves, that don't have health care, and don't have a place to live, while people spend millions of dollars in Center City going to lavish parties.
Poor people's activist Sherry Honkala in Philadelphia. The Democratic Party's presumptive presidential nominee, Hillary Clinton, ran the Caribbean country of Haiti with an iron fist when she was Secretary of State. Clinton helped to engineer the rise to the presidency of Michelle Sweet Mickey Martelly, who was finally forced out of power by popular demand this year. Nicholas Barry Shaw, a voting rights associate with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, says Clinton's record in Haiti is an embarrassment to her campaign, which would prefer that Haiti not be in the news.
The first time I heard it suggested that Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign was having an impact on the international community's response to these elections was when Ricardo Sanchez, a former Brazilian diplomat, spoke to the Haitian media and said, you know, what's going on here is the U.S. government is concerned for Hillary Clinton's campaign, and they want things to go smoothly, and they want these elections to stay out of the U.S. media, stay out of the spotlight, and allow Hillary Clinton's record in Haiti to go unexamined. And that's kind of been confirmed by many different voices since. It's been confirmed by people in the Haitian business sector. It's been confirmed by diplomats speaking to foreign journalists. And it's been confirmed by U.S. analysts of State Department policy in Haiti.
Hillary Clinton says she's the best candidate for president because she can get things done. What kind of things did she get done for Haiti while she was Secretary of State?
This is something that's surprising, right? Because on the one hand, Hillary is running her campaign on the basis of her foreign policy experience. But on the other hand, you very rarely get to hear about what the actual content of that experience is. And in Haiti in particular, they have not talked about it at all. You know, I searched the campaign website. I looked around. I couldn't find any statements from the Hillary campaign saying what good stuff they did in Haiti. And the reality is there isn't much to go on. Jonathan Katz, who is a correspondent in Haiti for many years before, during, and after the earthquake, did a review of all the projects that Clinton and her husband Bill and their allies kind of supported in the reconstruction process. And he came to the conclusion that very few ordinary Haitians had benefited from this process. But embarrassingly, a good number of people in the kind of inner circle of the Clinton family had benefited quite a bit. Tony Rodham became a board member of a mining firm with interests in gold mining in the north of Haiti.
That's her brother.
Her brother, Tony Rodham. And Dennis O'Brien, an Irish telecoms billionaire, got a number of contracts from the State Department shortly after paying for speeches by Bill Clinton in Ireland and Jamaica. So the kind of record is not very flattering to Clinton, and it's understandable that they don't want to bring the actual content of what they were doing in Haiti to the fore, which was trying to build. They talked about building back better, but the outcome was anything but.
Well, one of the things we know she did as Secretary of State was to tilt the scales in favor of Sweet Mickey Martelly, the U.S.'s favorite candidate.
Yeah, Martelly ended up ruling by decree in the last year of his mandate, in January 2015. And the reason he ended up in that position was that over the course of his mandate, he hadn't organized any elections that were mandated by the Constitution. And so really, the reason there is this electoral crisis and the reason that Haiti has had these kind of really disastrously bad elections is a direct result of Hillary Clinton's interventions in the last elections that got Martelly in place in 2011. In the elections that were held after the earthquake, there was similarly very low turnout and lots of instances of fraud and intimidation, lots of problems at the ballot box when the elections were held. And Hillary Clinton personally intervened when there were debates over how to resolve it, and flew down to Haiti, met with the president and said, you know, we're going to pull the visas of your ministers so that they can't travel to the States. We're going to cut off aid to your government. And even started plotting with other members of the international community to organize a coup against the current president if they didn't agree to put Sweet Mickey into the second round, even though, according to the very contested official results, he was in third place and would not have continued in the elections. And so it's really through this intervention by Hillary Clinton that Sweet Mickey gets into power. And afterwards, the ambassadors to Haiti that were appointed by her supported Mickey to the hilt, even though he didn't organize these elections. And so by 2015, you end up with Sweet Mickey ruling by decree and creating the situation where he feels confident enough about U.S. backing that he can go forward and organize these patently fraudulent elections. And fortunately, the Haitian people have been aware enough and mobilized enough to counter these plans.
The Clintons, as a couple, have long had financial dealings with Haiti. And of course, we are all familiar with the Clinton Foundation and its begging for money in exchange for who knows what all around the world. And many have suspected that the Clinton emails may have revealed a Haitian nexus as well that would be embarrassing, to say the least, for the Clintons.
Yeah, one of the things that came out with the Clinton emails from her private email server was that you got to read kind of all the backslapping going on amongst the various State Department players after they basically determined the outcome of elections in 2011. And really congratulating themselves. And, you know, you have people sending emails to Hillary saying, you know, gee, we do great elections, and talking about the kind of behind the scenes action that put an enormous amount of pressure on the current government to change the results in favor of Martelly and so on. So, you know, at this point, Hillary's record in Haiti is not a question of speculation or presumption. It's quite clear. All the evidence is there in WikiLeaks and in the private emails. And so any journalist doesn't have to do any particular, you know, amount of digging to find it. It's there, and it's pretty incontrovertible. And so the strategy of the Clinton campaign so far seems to have just been to ignore it, to keep it off the table and not talk about it at all, which has worked up until now.
Yes, it has worked up until now. Bernie Sanders has not had anything notable to say about Haiti at all.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's kind of surprising in the sense that it is one of the places where she would be the weakest. And I think it speaks to this, some of the limitations that came with Bernie Sanders' campaign being run through the Democratic Party, the desire to not go full throttle in attacking all the weak points of Hillary Clinton as a candidate. And what's interesting is that Donald Trump's campaign, of course, doesn't have any of those scruples. It has no scruples at all. And they've actually started picking up on the kind of dodgy investments and the ways that people like Hillary's brother and others benefited from this reconstruction process in Haiti that she was so instrumental in organizing as Secretary of State. And so that's going to be one of the questions, is going into the general election as the campaign fever kind of heats up, will Trump make this a major line of attack against Hillary? And I think if he does, it could be quite damaging to her.
Nicholas Barry Shaw of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Gunmen riddled the home of Haitian presidential candidate Dr. Maurice Narcisse, who represents Fanmi Lavalas, the political party of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was overthrown by a U.S.-backed coup in 2004. Aristide's party has been banned from most elections in Haiti since then. We spoke with Pierre Labassier of the Haiti Action Committee. He says the U.S. State Department fought tooth and nail to try to force the Haitian people to accept the results of last year's rigged elections.
It's immorality. Basically, what you are saying is nothing less as if Al Capone was occupying Haiti, and he had his goon squad trying to enforce the rule of the mafia in Haiti. This is what that so-called international community, as they call themselves, who are occupying Haiti, and I said the U.S., France, Canada, the European Union, the OAS is part of that. This is how the Haitian people see them. because this is the whole verification commission. It took about a month for them to verify in their presence in various sectors of Haitian society were represented in this open verification process of 25% of the records, the voting records. They were there, and they saw it. They verified some places where people don't know how to write. Then you can put your fingerprint. They had police experts from the UN, verifying whether these fingerprints were legitimate. They found that they were not. They were not legitimate. Nothing could be traced to anyone. Over 42% of the vote cast. And there were massive problems with the other votes as well. So you see, now the Haitian people are saying, enough of this. We are outraged by this. We see that these guys are nothing but plunderers, pirates, who are coming in and saying to us, our lives don't matter, that we are inferior, and we are supposed to accept anything that they dish out to us simply because they have money and they have guns. Well, the people of Haiti have said, we don't care about that. You can come in and kill us and force it upon us. Then let the world see that's what you are going to do. That's what you are doing.
And in fact, an attempt was made, it appears, on the life of the presidential candidate of your party, Fanmi Lavalas.
Yes, Fanmi Lavalas is the party of the majority of Haitian people because the majority of people see ourselves and our aspirations, even though I live here in the U.S., because it's the party that we see that articulates our aspirations and has a vision of society that most of the Haitian people share that same vision. And so there was an attempt, that was about a week ago, on groups from the people who conducted the fraud, from Martelly's party, former President Martelly and others, under the leadership of Evans Paul, the former prime minister. They are so upset that the Haitian people are saying, enough of all of this. And so these guys were so mad. When I say these guys, I mean the people who are involved, the Martelly people, the people who support Haitians, who support the occupation forces. And they've been encouraged by pronouncements from the U.S., from the European Union. And so they went on a rampage last week. They were breaking car windows and windshields and then shooting. And they shot up the office of the Fanmi Lavalas body. And one person was wounded as a result of that. So this is the kind of a situation. And what we are seeing in the press, the international press is pushing this line that Haiti is leaderless, you know, because the whole thing is so ludicrous.
Yes, if you read the corporate media, you see a picture being painted of Haiti in a state of chaos, as if there are no organized people struggling to hold elections to choose their own representatives.
And this is the big lie, you see, and this is what we are so accustomed to since the time of the founding of Haiti. They always paint this picture. There is no chaos. People are saying, we are going to do this right this time. We are going to have clean, fair, open, honest, democratic elections where every vote will count. And there is a timetable for the election. It's October 9th. And then the runoff will be a few months later. I believe it's December or January. They are still arguing about those dates. So there is a timetable. But what has happened is that the people who do the bidding of the occupation, they had already pre-selected the legislature and Jovenel Moïse from Martelly's party as president. And so because the Haitian people have said no to this, and that's why you are seeing this massive conspiracy. This is a very good attempt to muddy the waters, present Haiti as if it's chaos, it's a failed state, and what have you, and that way they can justify taking action against the people of Haiti to really create, to fish out of troubled waters. So they are troubling the waters' purpose in order to do that.
So Fanmi Lavalas and other parties will be trying to mobilize people to defend this process that moves towards elections in October.
Just like after we won our, the Haitian Revolution was won to abolish slavery, the whole picture that they painted of Haiti was a picture of Haiti being a chaotic place and what have you. So there's a purpose for that. So that people, the progressive movement or other people who value freedom, who are opposed to slavery back then and who today value freedom and democracy and are opposed to imperialism and the exploitation of one human being over another, so that these people do not have a clear picture of what's going on. They can turn and say, well, Haiti is a mess. It has always been a mess. No, there is no mess there. People have been in the streets of Haiti. They have mobilized. They were the ones who forced Martelly, the former dictator, to hold elections in Haiti. Even though they were forced to do it, what they tried to do, they tried to steal it. And the population said, no, that's not what we are about. We are about our voices, our vote to matter, so that we all can sit around the table and make decisions about the country. So the people have been in the streets relentlessly, and they continue to be. But as we saw in 2004, during that coup d'etat, they went outside of Haiti, created all of this misrepresentation of the situation, misrepresented the country. They turned it into a caricature, stereotype, and it made many people say, well, it's a mess. I don't know what to do. I just wash my hands of it. At a time when the Haitian people needed the solidarity of each and everyone in the whole world would stand up to their government and say, no, you shall not do this. You shall not do this. We stand with the people of Haiti. So people in France were confused. People in the U.S. were confused because they were getting that corporate media. And when I woke up this morning and I'm seeing those reports in the news and I'm talking to brothers and sisters in Haiti, it's two different realities. One is completely made up outside and presents that situation. And it's showing to us, as we were discussing with some of my brothers and sisters inside, they were saying to me, so this is the plot. Basically, the plot was hashed out before, even though it has been stopped inside Haiti, but the plan was to just blanket the news media outside of Haiti with this prepared phony stories, fabricated stories, and to put it out there.
These elections would occur in October. That's just 1 month before the U.S. presidential elections. And there's a school of thought that says that Hillary Clinton and her political allies want to divert attention from Haiti at all costs because her tenure as Secretary of State and her and Bill's dealings with Haiti don't reflect well on her as a candidate for president.
No, her tenure has been it's been shameful. And her husband, his role in the destruction of Haiti's agriculture, and he has asked for forgiveness for his role in having done so. But the problem is, though he has asked for forgiveness, he's been upfront about it, but still he goes back and keeps on doing the same thing. You know, it's like sinners who go and beg for forgiveness, and then they go back and keep sinning, repeating the same sin. And we haven't seen Mrs. Clinton get up there and admit to what she has done, the destruction of Haitian democracy.
And if finally in Haiti, in October and then the runoffs later on, there are legitimate and recognized elections, it would be theoretically very difficult for the United Nations to continue its occupation of the country.
Almost definitely. Haitians have always, they came in, and I'm talking about the UN, they came in really basically to replace the former discredited Haitian military, which the Haitian people have risen up against and said they eliminated because they were a bunch of parasites. They were sucking over 40% of the national budget. They didn't do anything but interfere with the democratic process by staging coup after coup after coup. They made life in Haiti, life for the people, a living hell. And really, it was a force that was to harass and extort the population and not to help and protect the people or the sovereignty of Haiti. So it was good riddance that they had rid of them. Now what happened is the UN has been brought in, borrowing troops from various countries that are part of the School of the Americas, that have been trained in how to oppress people, their own people. And so Haiti has been a laboratory for them to do what they were trained to do. And that's what they are doing right now. So they brought cholera to Haiti, and there are other governments too, besides governments from various Latin American countries that are part of it. The Nepalese troops brought cholera to Haiti, and the UN has continued to deny that and say, oh, no, they have nothing to do with it. Well, every evidence points. That's what they have done. The Brazilian troops particularly, and the Jordanians, and others as well, have carried a number of massacres that have been documented in, for example, Kevin Pina's film, Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits. And so these are the many things, and they have carried out rapes. They were involved, the troops, the UN troops have been involved in prostitution, carrying out rapes against boys and girls and women, detention, with no charges. I heard the story of one guy who's been in prison since 2004, since the coup. There were no charges against him. He was forgotten there. Others who should have been released were kept for longer than for 2 years after their release date was supposed to take effect, and a couple of them died in the jail. Power stories like that. All of this was taking place under the UN being in charge and supposedly training our police, the Haitian police. What kind of training is that? No wonder we are seeing all the atrocities that are being committed, the brutality and killings that are going on in Haiti. This is terrible, what's happening. And so there is so much evidence of this corrupt involvement and the complicity of all these so-called democracies in the corruption of Haiti that people there are saying, enough of this, no more.
So the United Nations has totally discredited itself in Haiti.
Oh, definitely. And as a matter of fact, the European Union issued a note saying how they disagreed the verification commission. And they are saying that they are shutting down their election monitoring. Well, the Haitian people are celebrating and saying, good riddance. Just make sure the door doesn't hit you on the behind, as you would say. Monies are going through these people's hands like crazy. And they are really to destroy the democratic process in Haiti, not to help the population. So both the UN and a lot of those international bodies are just there to, I mean, their reputation among the Haitian people and among serious observers, not only in Haiti, but outside of Haiti, is that it's complete disgrace. All of them have disgraced themselves, and they need to leave the country alone. And the Haitian people are determined to pay for own elections. Whenever we take care of it ourselves, we do a good job. We do a good job. And what I mean by we, I mean the people's government, just like when President Aristide was there, we did a good job in Haitians signing their own election. Whenever these outside forces come in, they come in with a plan. They are investing to get something out of it, and they usually finance the worst elements in the society, international plunderers. They get some crumbs out of it, and the rest of their brothers and sisters in the country suffer.
That was Pierre Labassier of the Haiti Action Committee. New federal rules would make it harder for people to get payday loans at usurious interest rates. Matt Stannard is policy director of Commonomics USA. He'd like to get rid of payday loans altogether and provide alternative financing to poor people.
There are solutions that can provide, even within the current financial paradigm, there are solutions that can provide for people short-term loans. The best idea, the most robust idea of those is through the post office. In 2014, the Postal Inspector General of the USPS released a report detailing how the post office could do a variety of financial services for people, including short-term loans or payday advances at extremely low interest rates, far lower obviously, than the 350 or more percent interest rates. We're talking more around 20% that the Postal Service could offer. They could do that. They already have the infrastructure to do that. They have huge economies of scale. They were very successful in doing that. And again, what's missing is the political will in Washington to have something like that happen.
Yes, and one doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. There are lots of countries that do just that, provide financial services through their postal system.
Indeed. And the United States did from 1911 through 1967. They had a very, very successful postal banking system. It was the envy of the world, and it was so successful that the big banks lobbied Congress to shut it down.
Yes, and lots of people seem to be lobbying Congress to do everything possible to cripple the U.S. Postal Service as well.
That's correct. You know, the post office doesn't take a dime of taxpayer money. There are post offices in every community, and so you have a sort of commons area, which would be a great place for people to do these transactions. But there is, of course, this legislation, this law, the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, that contains a poison pill requiring the post office to fund its pensions several decades into the future. If not for that requirement, which is a requirement that doesn't exist in other entity in the country, if not for that requirement, the Postal Service would appear financially solvent. And it really is financially solvent. The only reason that it appears otherwise is that piece of legislation.
And you say that these postal dispersers of financial services could be a great deal of help to communities that you describe as banking deserts. What's a banking desert?
Upwards of 100 million Americans have no access to local financial services and local cheap financial services. It's very expensive to be poor, and one of the reasons it's expensive to be poor is you either don't have access to a bank in your community, and you have to go to these payday lenders, even cash your paychecks, and then you also don't have access to short-term loans at a time when over 60% of Americans could not afford a $500 emergency. 12% of African Americans, as a total population, have taken out payday loans because, unsurprisingly, the constitution of these banking deserts are also very much in poor and minority neighborhoods.
The next Democratic presidential candidate, which will almost certainly be Hillary Clinton, will campaign on a record of doing things such as this reform in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's regulation of payday lenders. Would candidate Hillary Clinton have much to brag about in terms of this particular reform?
Well, she really has not been part of that conversation. Some credit, in very limited sense, could go to both Elizabeth Warren, who championed the idea when the initial Postal Inspector General report came out, and Bernie Sanders, who championed the idea through the early stages of his presidential campaign, although he has not come back around on it either. There's a great deal of cowardice right now in Washington, even, unfortunately, with the leadership of some of these postal unions who will come out in favor as sort of a bargaining chip and a demand, but they really won't push it very hard. There's just a perception that the Democratic Party, as much as the Republican Party, is really in pockets of the financial industry, and that includes payday loan industry, which is a very, very lucrative industry. And so I would not count on Clinton as a candidate or a president to really push the kind of robust reforms that we need, including postal banking, which would not only save upwards of 100 million of Americans, but it would also save the post office from the constant barrage of privatization attacks that it's under right now.
One would think that the postal unions would have an inherent interest in having the Postal Service play a more central role in communities and therefore be less disposable, and their jobs would be less disposable.
I think it's important to make a distinction between the rank and file members of these unions. I know several people in the APWU and the NALC, the American Postal Workers Union, the National Letter Carriers, who are really big fans of expanded postal services. The problem really lies in the Postal Board of Governors, of which there's only one member right now confirmed. There are several vacancies. And what happens is that members of both political parties keep advancing candidates to that Board of Governors who are big fans of privatization. And so in that context, the hierarchy of these postal unions will sort of veer back and forth depending on their sense of where the political winds are blowing. And they're really not putting their foot down and demanding the kind of changes that would both save the post office and make life easier for ordinary Americans.
Lots of people think of payday lenders as fly-by-night operations or rogue corporations, but that's not the case. We're talking about mainstream finance capital corporations.
We really are. And the interesting thing about it is that they're doing something right, which is they are going into these communities where the big banks will not go into, and they are establishing themselves as kind of members of the communities, and they are establishing a clientele with people in the community that don't have access to financial services otherwise. Now, within all of that, they are also charging people immoral amounts of money for their services, but what they're doing is they're going where other businesses are not going to. And so that means one of the likely effects of any kind of solution to regulate payday lending may very well be that fewer people will actually get those services, and they will have nothing to fill in the gaps of those services. So it's really a catch-22 for the communities that need these financial services.
And that's what black politicians in some of the most depressed communities in the country say when they're pressured to drop their support for payday lenders.
You know, I talked to my friend Steven Stetson, who is at Alabama Arise, a policy organization in Alabama. And he said when he talks to these leaders, when he talks to these elected officials, many of whom are African-American leaders in poor communities, they say exactly that, that the number one factor in the way that they calculate the risks and benefits of the payday lending industry is the lack of an alternative. Well, there is an alternative, and that alternative is postal banking. And I urge people to read that original 2014 Postal Inspector General report. It's very easy to find, and I urge people to read it because the math is really good in it. The Postal Service could do this. They could do this for a tiny fraction of the interest that these predatory lenders charge, and the post office would make a profit doing it because of its economies of scale.
A new report shows that New Jersey has the nation's highest racial disparity in incarceration rates, with blacks in the state 12 times more likely to go to prison than whites. The report is titled The Color of Justice, Racial and Ethnic Disparity in State Prisons. It's compiled by The Sentencing Project, a Washington-based prison reform group. Right behind New Jersey in racially disparate imprisonment are Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and Vermont, all states with relatively small black populations, but where African Americans are 10 times as likely to be incarcerated than whites. Mass black incarceration knows no bounds in the United States of America, the world champion of incarceration, with 2.3 million men and women behind bars. Some states are worse than others, but all of them are much worse for black people than for whites. Blacks don't make up a majority of any state in the country, but they are the majority of the prison population in 12 states: Alabama, Delaware, Georgia, Illinois, Louisiana, Maryland, Michigan, Mississippi, New Jersey, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. In terms of the proportion of black male population that is incarcerated at any given time, the prize goes to Oklahoma, where one out of every 15 black men, ages 18 or older, is currently living behind bars. In 11 other states, one out of every 20 black males has been snatched from his community. New Jersey stands out for high rates of racial disparity in incarceration and for having a black majority in the prison system. But in recent years, it's one of three states that have substantially reduced their prison populations. New York and California have also scaled down their gulags. According to the Sentencing Project, the key to shrinking the prison population lies in the intake valves of a criminal justice system that arrests far too many people, especially black people, and then locks them away for way too long. Project Executive Director Mark Maurer told Black Agenda Report that President Obama and his successors should consider clemency for whole categories of prisoners, similar to President Gerald Ford's amnesty for draft resistors back in 1974. But don't expect any late-term prisoner release surprises from Barack Obama, who went to court to keep about 5,000 federal crack cocaine prisoners behind bars, even after the racist legislation under which they were convicted was repealed and replaced. Without fundamental changes at every stage of the criminal justice process, black Americans will continue to make up something approaching 1 out of every 8 prison inmates in the world. Indeed, accounting for growth in U.S. population, by my calculations, the nation's jailers and prison wardens would have to set 4 out of every 5 of their prisoners free just to get incarceration rates down to the levels of 1972, when the effects of the national mass black incarceration regime were just starting to be felt. Of the 2.3 million current prison inmates, fully 80%, totaling 1,850,000 men and women, would have to be let go, and even then, the United States would still be a high incarceration nation. 1972 was 1 year after the Attica Rebellion, not a great time for black people in the criminal justice system. If only we had known that 44 years later, things would be far, far worse.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.